This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to John Manuel about his novel, Hope Valley. It's a story that takes place in Durham, North Carolina, a place actually where I think this story takes place almost literally within miles of where I once lived in Durham County, North Carolina. How are you, John?
I'm very well. Thanks, David.
It's really good to talk to you. I should point out to listeners that you and I have known each other for a really long time, but I haven't seen you in person in quite a few years.
Been at least 10 years.
Yeah. So I also think that I read this novel in an earlier form. How many years ago? How long have you been working on this book?
I've been working on it at least 10 years, and I think it's been 3 years since I passed that first version by you.
Well, I read it through both times, evidently, because I remembered the story as I was reading it the second time, and I really liked it. And maybe you should talk, I mean, it's a novel set in North Carolina, kind of more or less the present time, modern era. But it really does talk about or address some of the cultural clashes, maybe we would call them, that exist in modern day North Carolina. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what was your inspiration for writing a novel that's about culture in the Carolinas.
Back when I first moved to North Carolina in 1975, I was struck by how traditional a lot of it was compared to where I had lived in Ohio and Washington, D.C. This novel is set in the mid-1980s when Durham in particular was still pretty much a conservative, sleepy, former tobacco town, but the first rumblings of change were occurring in terms of younger people moving in, setting up small businesses, or working out in the Research Triangle Park. And so that was an inspiration to me to see these two cultures getting to know each other.
So I without giving away too much of the story, you really focus on this couple that have been in North Carolina for, you know, they're born and raised, you know, we don't necessarily know all of their ancestry, but they, you know, they're real typical local community members, you know, with their children, or one of their children nearby. And, they're the focal point of the story, this couple. Were they modeled? I mean, did you kind of have somebody in mind specifically, or are these kind of amalgamations of people that you met over the years in North Carolina?
The two main characters, Hurley and Opal, were modeled very directly on a couple that my wife and I moved next to on Hope Valley Road in Durham back in the early 80s. So a lot of what is in the book is based on my wife and I's 7-year interchange friendship with this couple. So, it was part of the challenge for me was to develop a plot and supporting characters that were different from what my wife and I experienced, just so we didn't sort of copy that exactly.
One of the things that I noticed when I lived in North Carolina just prior or right around the time you got there. You know, I think I got there in 1973 and stayed till about 1976. And I felt similarly. You know, I experienced something like what you did, which was, you know, I'd been from the North. I didn't really know or understand Southern culture very well. And I felt like I should be open to it. And I met people who had very different cultural outlooks than I did, different experiences, different belief systems. And what I liked about this novel in particular is that you treated them as human beings, you know, and I mean, I think yeah. that in a sympathetic way, without falling prey to, you know, the kind of typecasting one way or the other, you know, you could go either yeah. way. And I appreciated that. But I think I also felt like that was a hard thing to do.
Yeah, I had some friends early on who looked at early drafts and they said, oh, you should make Hurley a Klansman. You know, you should make him this sort of, you know, vicious racist. And I said, no, that's a typecast. That's a typical Northern preconception about conservative Southern farmers. And lots of people, as you well know, are conservative and maybe hold racist attitudes in a fashion that they've grown up with, but they're a far cry from a Klansman.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that it doesn't necessarily excuse what we might consider to be, you know, racist or prejudiced opinions, but I think it's important when you come face to face with people that you engage them, you know, in a fair way, in a reasonable way.
Right.
You know, you're not necessarily, you know, this is not a polemic. It's not like you're trying to convince anybody. But I think what fiction can do that nonfiction does not try to do is to explore perhaps the and kind of if you are telling a story, you have a way of in doing so of engaging people indirectly, perhaps. You know, I do tend to hark back to that class I took in fiction with David Milch once called Strategies of Indirection. And I always felt like that was so powerful to my understanding of how fiction worked, you know, that it is about not telling, but showing.
Right.
And
you know, a number of people who I've talked to who've read this book, who live down here in the Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill area said, oh, yeah, I knew a Hurley. I knew an Opal.
Right.
He lived next door to me on such and such a street, or they lived in the next farm over out in the county.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I think that you know, they're people and they have strengths and they have weaknesses, as we all do. You know, I think you could imagine living next door to a farmer in Nebraska or a farmer in Vermont and having to reach out to where they are in order to understand their perspective, because if you are not if you're not from that place, if you're not from that background culturally, you know, it won't be familiar territory.
Right. And you remember, David, back in the 70s and 80s, a lot of students and people who had just moved down here lived out in the country where they were in contact with people like Hurley and Opal, or lived in a working class neighborhood of Durham or whatever, and again, lived next door to somebody like that. So I think especially back then, there was a lot more interaction between people of different backgrounds.
Yeah, and I think what your story illustrates is how that affected people on both sides of that cultural divide, that it wasn't, although I think there was a lot of mistrust and a lot of lack of understanding, if you took the time and if you, whichever you were, whether you were the farmer meeting the hippie or the hippie meeting the farmer, if you worked at it, if you took the time to see the person who was different than you were as a human being, that you would find a way to overcome the differences. And
that's exactly right, David. And I like that you said, took the time to get to know the other person, because boy, that's what this novel is all about, is people taking the time to get to know each other, which seems to happen less and less these days.
Well, and one of the things, one of the values that I think you celebrate is this notion of communal, true communalism, which is the community based on personal relationships in shared physical circumstances. So if I right. move in next door to you and we don't necessarily see eye to eye, we still become humans to each other. If we allow that to happen. I mean, I know that sounds really kind of hopelessly romantic and sentimental, but I've seen, you know, where I've lived in places, not necessarily North Carolina, but other places, I could move in next door to somebody and not get along with them. It didn't matter that, you know, it wasn't about cultural difference, you know? So I think a lot [S2] Right. [S1] a lot of the time, what you're, and I think this was an important part of the novel for me, was that one of the strongest values of country people in the South is that notion of mutuality, that right. if your next door neighbor is in trouble or if needs something, you help. That is just not even questioned, you know, yeah. so that Hurley goes across the street. Now, it's not like he's, you know, I mean, there are limits too. It's not like they, you know, that you also respect the individuality and independence of your neighbor as well. But yeah. you when they need you, you help them.
Yeah, and even when they don't need you, is such a amazing part of my and my wife's 7-year relationship with this elderly couple, was how many times they would just see us in the yard and go, "John, come over and sit on the porch.
Right.
Kathy, come over and sit on the porch." They just yep. wanted you to come over and talk.
Right. I know that part, that is really something that we are rapidly losing. And I know, you know, we will sound like old fogies, but there are values in the quietude that we are lacking in our noisy, extraordinarily busy world, where we don't have the opportunity to just, as they used to say, sit a spell.
Yeah, and think about this. 1985, for those of us our age, was really not that long ago. And yet, there was no internet. There were no cell phones. So if you take all that time that we spend in front of the computer or on the phone, and you devote half of that to sitting with a neighbor talking, just think of the difference in the way we live now.
Well, Annette, I think now we can get into a little bit of political discourse. You know, we can imagine that one of the reasons why we have a distrustful gulf among almost like warring tribes in our society is that we don't have time for actual human interaction, and we spend far too much time in disconnected, alienated discourse, you know, where you're either hearing from people that you agree with and never get to experience otherness, or you're shouting at the top of your lungs in some you know, digital form about something yeah. that really matters to you. All of that, you know, as we know, because it's disconnected from human interaction, is unmodified by kind of the restraining effect of being with actual people.
That's exactly right.
So, you know, this is one of the things I liked about the book is that it reminded me of, you know, a kind of different, you know, it's sort of funny because I said at the beginning, this takes place in the modern era, and it does. But what we define as modern is actually oddly wrong, you know, where I was wrong, because in a way, 1985 isn't the present anymore.
Right.
You know, I kind of, yeah. I guess because of our age, you know, since we've experienced enough time, we kind of, the present feels like anything that happened in the last 40 or 50 years. But, you know, as you're saying, that was a really long time ago, and it's hard to to sometimes even remember that. You know, what I think North Carolina looked like in that, I think about that sometimes. You know, I lived in South Carolina for 1 year, and in 1974, 1975, when you got there, that was only about 10 years since the civil rights legislation had upended social relationships there. That's not a long time.
No, it isn't.
And as you say, you know, as you show, and Durham, you know, is kind of peculiar. Durham and Chapel Hill in North Carolina were always, you know, as the college towns, different than the rest of the state in a bigger way than even today, I think. But the cultural clash might not have occurred, you know, like before the 70s. And as you show in the novel, there was a certain amount of development going on. You know, the county where you were, where the story takes place, was once pretty much rural farmland, maybe up until 1970 or 75. Well, actually through 75 and maybe up into the early 80s. So your story takes place right at that moment where development is bringing the city out to the country. In a way that had, and if you went another, like if you were, you know, 20 miles farther away, maybe that story would be different.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's always interesting, I think, you know, kind of, and since you're an environmental writer, you know about, you know, the creativity that occurs in the edges of ecosystems, you know, where two different species interact with each other. That's where creativity takes place.
Well, that's a good point, yeah.
And that's where your story takes place. You know, it's that
yeah.
kind of growing urban suburbanism. Now, I have not been to where you are in a long time, so I assume it's become even more developed today than it was in this last, you know, than it was 30 years ago.
Yeah, the hilltop farm where this takes place the hill was actually leveled and a apartment complex built on top of it. And there's now an enormous shopping center just down the road and bumper to bumper traffic. And it's changed dramatically.
So do you feel, you know, as you have, you know, even though you're not a local person, you've been there long enough now that it becomes your community. Is there a sense around that area of the loss of something, or is it once that the suburbanism kind of obliterates the previous landscape that people quickly adapt, forget what was there before, or never knew?
Yeah, the latter is true. Most of the people who've moved in there don't have any recollection of what it was like. And I think if I think of who the neighbors were at that time, most of them are dead now. So there's no sense of what was there that I can perceive.
So do you think that it's sort of an idle curiosity, but for, you know, I read a book once called Everything You Love Is Gone. And it was about the way this actual process, you know, in America. I can't remember the woman's name who wrote it, but she grew up in Ohio like you did. And where she grew up, you know, it was kind of rural suburban. maybe down by Dayton or something. And, you know, growing up in the 50s, like you did and I did, you know, it was kind of magical, playful, open land, even though it was suburbia. And then you go back, you know, 10, 20, 30 years later, and the landscape as you knew it is completely obliterated. You know, the ability to look at that and feel remorse and kind of the sense of loss, you know, I think that's fairly common. And I think, you know, her book is really about the continual displacement of landscape, of change in the way things are, you know, the way the world operates in America, you know, modern times. It's accelerated, as we know. Do you have access to people like the children of the, you know, of the people that were your neighbors, people who grew up there? Is there any sense of what's become of them? Like, do they, have they moved away because it's too different now, or are they part of the community, or is it completely different?
I don't know what's become of them. My guess would be they've certainly moved farther out in the county because that's the only place that people of modest means can afford to live in Durham anymore. The city and immediate suburbs have gotten prohibitively expensive for working class folks to live in. So, but I don't know what's happened to them.
Oh, it's interesting. So do you feel, do you see yourself as a, you know, is this writing novels is something you want to do, or is now that you've written this one and kind of gotten it done, that it's, you know, you're happy with it and you're going back to the nonfiction, environmental writing that you've been doing for the last 20, 30, 40 years? Or, you know, are you continuing to write fiction?
Yeah, I think I've gotten the bug, and I think I was moving in this direction for the last 6 or 8 years after a sort of a long career of journalistic writing. And I have started to write short stories and am about to get to work on another novel. So I've gotten the bug, and even if I don't sell, you know, 500 copies of this book, I've been bit by the bug.
Well, I think it's a good, at least it appears to be a good bug for you to have caught. Do you, now you self-published this book. Was that like a conscious choice? I mean, did you explore other opportunities, or tell me what,
how that worked? Oh yeah. I spent 3 years trying to find an agent for this book. And I researched and wrote to 50 agents. I didn't just send out a, you know, mass email. I, you know, carefully researched agents and sent them individually crafted letters. And it was very disappointing. I think only one requested to see any more than the first three chapters. And none of them, in turning it down, gave me any information at all other than, thank you for your submission, we can't use it at this time. So after I'd hit 50, I said, that's enough. I'm going to self-publish this because I'm tired of trying to go the other route.
And you're happy with the outcome?
I really am. You know, some of the benefits of self-publishing are you can craft the look of the book the way you want it. I hired a friend to do the cover, and I thought he did just a fantastic job.
Yeah, I like the cover. I think it came out really well.
Yeah, and you can get it out much more quickly. Once I decided to self-publish, I had this thing out in less than a year. And boy, if you go through an agent and a publisher, you're talking about years.
This is true. Well, and that is one of the, you know, that is one of the issues in the modern world. You know, we were talking about before, everything's about speed now. So
right.
It's more troubling that the process of publishing, even though it is completely understandable why it takes so long for publishers to publish, it's still harder and harder to justify. So for many authors, self-publishing is a viable, it's not just out of the fact that there aren't enough opportunities with commercial publishers, but that self-publishing does have these advantages. I mean,
right.
Of course, the difficulty then is as it is for any book, how to get it discovered by people.
Yeah, exactly.
So have there been have you done events for it in Durham, in the Durham Chapel Hill area, North Carolina?
Not yet. I'm planning a big event on April 7th at a musical establishment called Motorco here in Durham. And I'm actually going to do a combination of reading and music. I've picked out about half a dozen songs that, to me, bring to life certain passages in this book. And so I'm going to read, interspersed with playing some acoustic songs with some of my friends.
Oh, that sounds really interesting. So maybe you should record that. Or
I plan to. Yeah. I plan to hire somebody to do a video.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I think that should be fun. So what other what other kinds of writing have you been doing lately?
I've done a couple of short stories that were published in one in what's called the Savannah Anthology and the other in the New Southerner. The New Southerner was interesting in that it's actually a creative nonfiction piece that grew out of a assignment I was given to go down to Eastern North Carolina and write sort of a promotional piece on a 3,000-acre piece of land that somebody was trying to sell with conservation in mind. And when I got down there, I was met by five people who all had different relations to this land. One was a forester, one was a realtor, one was a good old boy, white guy who owned the land, and his trophy wife. And the land itself was pretty uninteresting. It was just flat, a pine forest. But as I was driven around by this group and listened to their different hopes for this land, I saw a fantastic, kind of like a New Yorker piece developing. So I never ended up writing the piece that they wanted me to, which would have been a sort of promotional thing to hopefully entice somebody to buy it. And instead, I wrote this creative nonfiction piece.
Is there a strong literary community in Durham Chapel Hill?
Yes, it's just enormous, and especially Hillsboro, you've got all these writers living out there. But there are many, many lesser known writers here in Durham and Chapel Hill, and I find out about them every other week. You see a review in the paper of some local author that you'd never heard of before.
Well, I think it's good to have that around you. It makes it a support system in a certain way. Although, maybe in another way, it's sort of like, well, there's so many writers here. How is anybody going to, hear about me?
Well, that's the truth. That's the truth. That's part of it.
Well, I wish you luck with this book. I think it's really good, and I hope that you find a readership. Probably, thinking about the concentric circles, it's usually the nearest first, the people that are nearest to you.
And right.
Hopefully, because it's a local novel, takes place in a real place that has some resonance for people, and they'll recognize the name of the book as being the name of an actual street.
Right. Well, and I'm also hoping that because the themes of this book have suddenly become so timely, given what's happened in our national political landscape, that it will gain an audience amongst people who are interested in trying to connect with people different from themselves, from rural folks or conservative folks or whatever. Yeah. When I first started writing this, I had no idea that it would have the timeliness that it does now, but hopefully that'll work to its advantage.
Well, I hope that if people do read the book in that context, that the book will help bring people together in a way. You know, it doesn't mean that you have to give up your ideas or your ideals in order to relate to people who disagree with you.
Right.
And that's something, I think that's a lesson, you know, that I don't mean that your book is really, you know, meant to be read as lesson giving, but I think it does convey that, that the notion that, we can be different and yet yes. We can still coexist. I think that's important because right now, I think those differences are being used by some to drive people apart.
That's very true. And it's very sad. Yeah,
I agree. And we need to do everything possible to, prevent that from happening. Not necessarily, do we know how to do that? But, I hope you're right. I hope this book can be seen in that context. I think that it would be very valuable, for a lot of people to read it in that way. You know, maybe you can get it to be one of those one book things, you know, where everybody in Durham reads it, you know, and talks about it. That would be really, really fun.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping.
Well, thank you, John. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to John Manuel about his novel, Hope Valley. It's set in North Carolina, Durham, North Carolina, on Hope Valley Road.